All right, listening to WRUV FM Burlington. This is James with Radio Lyceum. This is the third show of the series. This is my third show of doing a talk show. So hopefully you guys are having a fun time out there. I don't know why you would be having a fun time out there. It's been some bad news everywhere. But hey, we're not talking about that kind of thing. We're getting into like how you can organize your community better, how to make friends, sociology, social capital, all that kind of fun stuff. We're starting out this week with some excerpts from Hidden Potential, The Science of Achieving Greater Things, by Adam Grant. Off the top of it, it's a super dense book, as in not like hard to read, but most books you read, you kind of like, okay, get to the point. This book, very solid, organized, gets to the point. I really appreciate it. So, but we're going to go over some things that he talks about, how to build better teams, how to basically, this show is basically going to be about how to leverage your social groups for better learning. So we've talked about it before. We did a little bit, a snippet about Einstein and how he leveraged his social groups to come up with the theories he had. I would say he wouldn't be able to do the things he did without the social groups he had, the friends that he had. So, and I'm making a case to be like, hey, here's how to leverage your social groups for, I know this is a university. This is where you can learn to improve your studies and have a good time hanging out with your friends at the same time. Like, it's a double win. It's a double win. So without further ado, let's get into it. Let's let Adam Grant speak for himself.
Qualities like being disciplined and pro-social, he called them virtues of character. He described character as a set of principles that people acquired and enacted through sheer force of will. I used to see character that way too. I thought it was a matter of committing to a clear moral code. But my job is to test and refine the kinds of ideas that philosophers love to debate. Over the past two decades, if you build it, they will climb. When people talk about nurture, they're typically referring to the ongoing investment that acting out of character. Pro-social, he called them virtues of character. He described character as a set of principles that people acquired and enacted through sheer force of will. I used to see character that way too. I thought it was a matter of committing to a clear moral code. But my job is to test and refine the kinds of ideas that philosophers love to debate. Over the past two decades, the evidence I've gathered has challenged me to rethink that view. I now see character less as a matter of will and more as a set of skills. Character is more than just having principles. It's a learned capacity to live by your principles. Character skills equip a chronic procrastinator to meet a deadline for someone who matters deeply to them. A shy introvert to find the courage to speak out against an injustice. And the class bully to circumvent a fistfight with his teammates before a big game. Those are the skills that great kindergarten teachers nurture and great coaches cultivate. When Maurice Ashley assembled his chess team for the national championships, a student named Francis E. Dehen wasn't one of the best eight players. Maurice picked him anyway due to his character skills. As Francis tells me,
another kid was a superior chess player, but he hadn't developed the emotional self-regulation that Maurice felt was important.
And when the Raging Rooks fell behind in the penultimate round of nationals, Maurice Ashley didn't pull out a book of secret plays. He didn't talk to them about strategy at all.
I reminded them about discipline,
he notes, a skill they'd been practicing together for 2 years. Their character skills caught the eye of the legendary chess coach, Bruce Pandolfini, who had guided multiple protégés to national and world championships. After watching the Raging Rooks march to victory, Pandolfini marveled. Nothing fazed them. Most kids under pressure will start hurrying a little bit or showing their feelings, but not them. They took their time and they were absolutely poker-faced at the board. I've never seen kids that age so cool. They were like professionals. If a knight on the chessboard was a Trojan horse, inside it, Maurice had smuggled an army of character skills. That helped the Raging Rook surge as their opponents floundered.
Character played an incredible role for all of us being successful in uniting as a team. And then for all of us to do that and accomplish what we did was a testament to the character of all those involved.
Maurice had seen the value of character skills in his own life. Growing up, he watched his mother sacrifice everything to move to America while his grandmother stayed behind in Jamaica to raise him and his siblings. When they finally made it to New York a decade later, they knew opportunity wouldn't just come knocking. They'd have to build their own doors. After stumbling onto a book about chess in his high school library, Maurice decided to join the school team. But he quickly discovered he wasn't good enough. He poured himself into improving and went on to become the captain of his college team.
You know, I definitely came in not with a master plan. In fact, even when I got the job to teach chess to kids, it was just by accident. Like, I didn't go looking for the job. Not like I thought, let me go save some kids. Somebody just walked up to me and said, would you like to teach chess in the Bronx and in Harlem? I was like, what? I didn't even know. Until they said, you know, it's a part-time gig, but you make $50 an hour at your level. That sounds damn good. Let me do it.
Today, if you ask anyone in the chess world about Maurice, they'll tell you he's a brilliant strategist. But he believes character matters more than talent.
For me, yes, character matters far more than talent. And I've watched very talented people fail. The kids who lose and cower and shy away from the game, and even when they're super talented, they can't tolerate the first time when their talent hits the ceiling for a plateau, and they're getting punched at that level. To make the breakthrough requires character.
Sure enough. Evidence shows that although kids and novices learn chess faster if they're smarter, intelligence becomes nearly irrelevant in predicting the performance of adults and advanced players. In chess, like in kindergarten, the early advantages of cognitive skills dissipate over time. On average, it takes over 20,000 hours of practice to become a chess master and over 30,000 to reach grandmaster. To keep improving, you need the proactivity, discipline, and determination to study old games and new strategies. Character skills do more than help you perform at your peak. They propel you to higher peaks. As Nobel laureate economist James Heckman concluded in a review of the research, character skills predict and produce success in life. But they don't grow in a vacuum. You need the opportunity and motivation to nurture them. If you build it, they will climb. When people talk about nurture, they're typically referring to the ongoing investment that parents and teachers make in developing and supporting children and students. But helping them reach their full potential requires something different. It's a more focused, more transient form of support that prepares them to direct their own learning and growth. Psychologists call it scaffolding. In construction, scaffolding is a temporary structure that enables work crews to scale heights beyond their reach. Once the construction is complete, the support is removed. From that point forward, the building stands on its own. In learning, scaffolding serves a similar purpose. A teacher or coach offers initial instruction and then removes the support. The goal is to shift the responsibility to you so you can develop your own independent approach to learning. That's what Maurice Ashley did for the Raging Rooks. He set up temporary structures to give them the opportunity and motivation to learn. When he started teaching chess, Maurice saw other instructors line up all the pieces to teach the standard opening moves. King's pawn forward two spaces, followed by knight up one and diagonal one. But he knew learning the rules could be boring, and he didn't want kids to lose interest. So when he first showed up to introduce the game to a group of sixth graders, he did it backward. He put a handful of pieces on the board and began at the end game. He taught his students different ways to checkmate their opponents. That structure was their first bit of scaffolding. It's often said that where there's a will, there's a way. What we overlook is that when people can't see a path, they stop dreaming of the destination. To ignite their will, we need to show them the way. That's what scaffolding can do. By teaching the game in reverse, Maurice lit a fire of determination. Once students knew how to corner a king, they had a route to victory. Once they had a way to win, they had a will to learn.
You don't tell kids, well, you're going to learn patience and determination and fortitude, because they'll fall asleep right away. You say this game is fun. Let's go. I'm going to beat you. You stir their spirit, their competitive fire. They sit down, they start learning the game, and as they become hooked and they lose a game, now they want to win.
It wasn't long before Cassan Henry would lie in bed at night, imagine 64 squares on his ceiling, and play out entire matches in his mind. Maurice also introduced scaffolding for the players to support one another's development. He taught them creative ways to share techniques. They drew cartoons about chess moves, wrote science fiction stories about chess matches, and recorded rap songs about commanding the center of the board. They were learning to treat a solitary game as a pro-social exercise in teamwork. When a player cried at nationals, it wasn't because he lost. He was devastated that he had let his teammates down. As they gelled into a team, the players started taking the motivation and opportunity to learn into their own hands. They held one another accountable for recording every move of their games on score sheets so the whole group could learn from individual mistakes. They weren't worried about being the smartest player in the room. They were aiming to make the room smarter. The previous year, at their first nationals, the Raging Rooks had finished in the top 10% despite being short on players due to budget constraints. When Maurice set a goal for them to win the following year, it was the players who took the initiative to plan. Now that they had the skill, they had the will. They created their own makeshift chess camp, spending the summer practicing and reading books. They cajoled Maurice into dedicating his summer off to their training. They had moved into the driver's seat. In an ideal world, students wouldn't have to rely on one coach for these opportunities. The scaffolding Maurice created was a substitute for a broken system. Empirically, character skills matter more for individuals from disadvantaged backgrounds. As Maurice put it,
structural and cultural oppression amplify the need for the skills learned through character building. You've got to be strong when the proverbial knee has been on your neck for generations.
There's an 8-year-old I taught in a school, and his mother came in and she was in tears or on the edge of it. She said, thank you so much for teaching my kid chess. And he came home and he said, I know how to play. And I told him, no, you don't. The feeling the woman was saying was, I didn't believe in my own kid.
He wasn't just helping his players reach their potential. He was helping their parents and teachers recognize it too. Few of us are lucky enough to have a coach like Maurice Ashley. We don't always have access to the ideal mentors, and our parents and teachers aren't always equipped to provide the right scaffolding. Mysterious messages came in different forms, but the recipients all felt the urgency. Jesse Arbor was in the midst of a poker game when someone told him a car was waiting downstairs and his train would leave in 35 minutes. He didn't even have time to get some of his clothes out of the washing machine. James Hare was out on a tugboat when he was sent back to shore to retrieve a big brown envelope. As he broke the red wax seal, what he found inside wasn't an invitation. It was an order to report to a location north of Chicago. That order was delivered to 16 men around the country. They ranged from their mid-20s to mid-30s and came from varying walks of life. The group included a mechanic, a bookbinder, a porter, a lawyer, and a sheet metal worker. It was January 1944, and they had no idea what was in store for them. In the heat of World War II, they would have a chance to make history. They were about to become the first black men to enter officer training in the U.S. Navy. Among the branches of the military, the Navy was known to be particularly prejudiced. Just a quarter century earlier, the Navy had banned black citizens from enlisting altogether. When the policy finally changed, black men were limited to servile roles as cooks and shoeshiners. Now, political pressure from Eleanor Roosevelt had cracked the door open for them to join the officer ranks, but many leaders doubted whether they were smart enough to command white sailors. When they arrived for officer training, the black candidates were in their own cohort, segregated from the white sailors. They endured racial slurs and demeaning comments from the very instructors who were assigned to teach them. To them, the message was clear. They were expected to fail. Some of the men had additional reasons to doubt themselves. A few had struggled academically in the past. Jesse Arbour was a C student who had failed introductory economics, and Charles Lear hadn't made it past 10th grade. And William Sill White had no military experience at all, having just finished his basic training at boot camp. White recalled, "It was demanding." To make matters worse, with the country at war, the training period was cut in half. The candidates had to complete a full semester of coursework in just 10 grueling weeks. They would wake up each day at 6 a.m. to march, take 8 hours of classes, and study well into the night. They were tasked with mastering seamanship, navigation, gunnery, law, naval regulations, aircraft recognition, signaling with flags and Morse code, and survival, all in record time. In a typical Navy officer training class, only 3/4 of candidates passed their exams. But that first class of black officer candidates didn't just scrape by. All 16 of them soared far above the bar. Leaders in Washington were immediately suspicious. To prove they hadn't cheated or benefited from grading errors, the men had to retake some of their exams. They ended up scoring even higher, finishing with a collective GPA of 3.89 out of 4. Years later, they would learn that they attained the highest marks in Navy history. Their potential was no longer hidden. 13 of the candidates ended up being called to serve as Navy officers. It's still unknown why 3 of the original 16 candidates, Augustus Alves, J.B. Pinkney, and Lewis Mummy Williams, weren't called up. It also remains something of a mystery why these 16 men were chosen in the first place. As the first group of black men in America to wear gold stars and stripes, they're known as the Golden 13. Instead of succumbing to the forces of gravity weighing them down, the Golden 13 managed to rise above them. As Samuel Barnes observed,
"We said that we are going to succeed, and not because of them, but in spite of them. And we know the burden that's on our shoulders."
The Golden 13 got something right that the rest of us often get wrong. In the face of seemingly insurmountable obstacles, it can be tempting to give up. It's just too hard. The forces against us are just too strong. At times like this, we're advised to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. The message is that we need to look inside ourselves for hidden reserves of confidence and know-how. But it's actually in turning outward, to harness resources with and for others, that we discover and develop our hidden potential. When the odds are against us, focusing beyond ourselves is what launches us off the ground. Thank you. Facing a daunting task, we need both competence and confidence. Our ability to elevate our skills and our expectations depends first on how we interpret the obstacles in front of us. Extensive evidence shows that when we view hurdles as threats, we tend to back down and give up. When we treat barriers as challenges to conquer, we rise to the occasion. Seeing obstacles as challenges depends partly on having a growth mindset, believing in your ability to improve. But the pioneering psychologist behind this idea, Carol Dweck, has recently demonstrated that a growth mindset alone does little good without scaffolding to support it. Rigorous experiments with over 15,000 students reveal that nurturing a growth mindset among high schoolers boosts their grades only when their teachers recognize their potential and their schools have cultures of embracing challenges. If we aren't lucky enough to have others hand us that scaffolding, we may have to assemble it ourselves. That's where bootstrapping comes in. Bootstrapping is using your existing resources to pull yourself out of a sticky situation. The term is sometimes traced to a folktale about a baron who was stuck in a swamp with his horse and escaped by using his pigtails as a rope. Later tellings may have replaced the baron's hair with his bootstraps. Bootstrapping is normally seen as an individual skill. You don't rely on assistance from others. You pull at the loop at the back of your own boots to lift yourself over obstacles. It sounds like an expression of rugged individualism, an independent act. But it's when we approach it interdependently that we gain the competence and the confidence to overcome obstacles. I saw it happen in my own classroom. One fall, I told my students at Wharton that the final exam would be unusually difficult and sent them some sample questions. They came to class panicked about the multiple choice section. I'd wanted to motivate them to master the material, but I'd undermined their confidence. I reminded them that I was rooting for all of them to succeed. I even promised to curve their scores upward if the class average was low. They were still stressed and filled with doubts, so I decided to throw them a bone. For the one multiple choice question that stumped them, they could write the name of a classmate who might know the answer. If that student got it right, they would get credit too. It was the academic equivalent of a lifeline in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? When I looked at their scores on the exam, I was in for a surprise. Compared to the past year's exam, the class average had gone up by multiple points, and it wasn't due to the lifeline. In subsequent years, the performance of each new class continued to climb. I started cycling through the list of possible explanations. The test hadn't gotten easier. The students weren't smarter than previous years. Eventually, I found out what was going on. The small lifeline had a big impact on how students prepared. To excel on the exam, the students still had to master all the content. It wasn't as simple as dividing and conquering the material. But if they wanted the extra credit on one question, they had to find out who knew what. So instead of cramming solo, they opted to study together. They started meeting in small groups to synthesize the key concepts. The students had created their own scaffolding. A later class took the collaboration to the next level. They created a giant map of the content from the entire semester. One student reserved a room for Saturday afternoon studying and invited the entire class to join and pool their knowledge. Others jumped in to share their own reading summaries, study guides, and practice quizzes. The students realized that the strongest bootstraps weren't the ones they created alone, but the ones they built together. Considerable evidence shows that studying with knowledgeable colleagues is good for growth. In U.S. intelligence agencies, if you want to predict which teams will produce the best work, the most important factor to consider is how often colleagues teach and coach one another. In medical schools, students learn as much when they're taught by peers as by faculty. In the Saturday session in my class, no single student walked in an expert. They had to leverage the collective knowledge of the group. And there's reason to believe that they did some of their learning by teaching. Teaching is a surprisingly powerful method of learning. In a meta-analysis of 16 studies, students who were randomly assigned to tutor their peers ended up earning higher scores in the material they were teaching. Students who taught reading improved in reading. Those who taught math got dramatically better at math. The more time they spent tutoring, the more they learned. As one group of researchers concluded, like the children they helped, the tutors gained a better understanding of and developed more positive attitudes toward the subject matter covered in the tutorial program. Psychologists call this the tutor effect. Unexpected potential. At the outset of officer training, many members of the Golden 13 felt it would be impossible to accumulate so much knowledge in so little time. As George Cooper captured it,
Nietzsche was saying, the hell with it. You know, this is just too damn much.
With few leaders supporting them, their best hope was to support one another. But they would have to do so in a notoriously cutthroat environment. Since Navy tradition held that not everyone would make the cut, officer candidates tended to see one another as rivals, not teammates. Yet the Golden 13 met in their barracks and made a pro-social vow, all for one and one for all. As Cooper stated,
we decided early in the game that we're going to either sink or swim together. Fortunately, one of us was familiar with almost every subject we were exposed to.
To manage the overwhelming course load, the Golden 13 resolved to rely on one another. They would become sponges by pooling and filtering the knowledge in the room. Each member would teach his expertise to the rest of the group. When they got their textbooks, they went through the topics and waited for someone to shout out, "That's mine." Being strong in math, Cooper, Graham Martin, and Reginald Goodwin led many of the analytical subjects, along with John Reagan on technical topics. The history buffs, Samuel Barnes and Dennis Nelson, took charge on military history. What Lear lacked in formal education, he made up in leadership, as well as experience with seamanship and knot tying. So he chipped in there along with Alves. And since Arbor had advanced navigation training and experience, the group turned to him for a crash course on Morse code. He tapped on the wall and gave his peers clues as they tapped back. They were tying their bootstraps together. The official time for lights out was 10:30 p.m. Night after night, the Golden 13 huddled in the bathroom with flashlights, studying well past midnight. To make sure they wouldn't get caught, they hung sheets over the windows to block the light. I learned about the Golden 13 thanks to a seminal book by Paul Stilwell, a Navy historian who did the great service of documenting their experiences before they passed away. As I pored over his extensive interviews for stories, quotes, and insights, the obvious explanation for their success was that they were able to learn from qualified peers. Then it occurred to me that the tutor effect was also at play. The act of sharing knowledge enhanced the competence of the men doing the teaching. They were working together to build stronger bootstraps. When the first law question came up, everyone turned to White as the lawyer. He told them he had no knowledge of Navy law. He had to look it up. He learned Navy regulations by teaching them and gained efficacy in subjects he had just learned in boot camp by teaching some of those too. Serving as an instructor made the lessons stick. Drawing on his background as a machinist, Frank Sublett was responsible for mechanical, gunnery, and boilers, along with Dalton Baugh. But plenty of questions came up that they couldn't answer. When the appointed teacher didn't have relevant knowledge, the Golden 13 went around the room for everyone to weigh in. It gave them all the chance to teach something relatively new to them. Once they'd reached a consensus about the best explanation, it was time for drilling and grilling. By quizzing one another, they created more opportunities for everyone to share knowledge they just gained. As he saw that they each had insights to offer, Sublett realized that
most of those fellows have PhDs and, well, also all kinds of degrees in our group. And so they had the capacity, the ability to grasp the information.
Their boots were sturdy. By the time they took their exams, they each had the knowledge to pass every subject with flying colors. Throughout the winter, the Golden 13 leaned on one another for coaching and encouragement. To rally the group, Lear showed up early. When they struggled with learning to use a sextant for navigation, he motivated them to keep trying and guided them on techniques. It showed him and his peers that he had a contribution to make. In coaching one another, the Golden 13 didn't just offer advice and encouragement. They also held one another accountable. As George Cooper recounted,
each one of us at some point in time, maybe at more than one point in time, got to the point where we were throwing the towel. And the others would have to be there to say, oh, no, man, we can't do this.
Graham Martin told them they had to make the grade and shot down excuses for slacking off. Others called their peers out if they got distracted and exchanged tips for staying focused. As they pulled one another up by their bootstraps, their expectations of themselves rose. After interviewing most of the Golden 13, Paul Stilwell marveled at their response.
Even their toughest instructors weren't as demanding of them as they were of themselves.
The difficult task in front of them was no longer a threat. It was a challenge. Instead of doubting themselves individually, they believed in their collective capacity. As George Cooper articulated it,
we were convinced that if one of us made it, we were all going to make it.
The Golden 13 found a way to fill the initial gaps in their confidence and competence. But with leaders doubting them, there would be plenty of reasons ahead for them to question themselves. When other people don't believe in your abilities, it can tie your boots to the ground or send you running in the other direction. Being disrespected presents a particular barrier to growth and requires a particular kind of scaffolding to overcome.
Listen to WREV FM Burlington. This is James with Radio Lyceum. You've been listening to, for the last half hour, Hidden Potential, The Science of Achieving Greater Things by Adam Grant. There's a bunch of other books out there as well. I highly recommend. Talks with Malcolm Gladwell, always interesting to see these two. Discussing topics. It's probably how I found out about him. Just a little bit of a cut in a little bit. So the method he's kind of talking about there, which I think he kind of goes into a little bit of detail later, but is a jigsaw method of learning, which you can use in group learning, where you basically assign, you have a group of students that are trying to study for something, you assign one student in that group, as in if you're have a study group of your own, be like, hey, can you go through quantum physics in our physics class and just tell us what the deal is with that, and then come back and teach it to the rest of us. And Tony over there, can you go through quantum field theory, and you could study about that and come back and tell us what the is about. So kind of breaking out the detailed studying. Because it's two different things. Basically, teaching helps you learn better than actually learning. But also knowing the social interaction part helps your brain activate certain parts of the brain that actually will help you learn. Which I'll cover a little more in detail with some of the other later things, later snippets that I have. A particular snippet called social that I played last week, why our brains are wired to connect. Just a little snippet about learning, but we'll get into that after we finish up the snippets from Hidden Potential. But I want to kind of just prime that thought in your head a little bit ahead of time. In the background, listen to Quasar by Mr. Fingers, just in case you want to know what the background music is. You can reach me. You can call me here at the station, 656-4399. You can also reach out to the radio program email, radiolyceum, all one word, at protonmail.com. Suppose you want to know how to spell Lyceum. Doesn't everyone know how to spell? So, radio, RadioLyceum. It's Greek. So that's RadioLyceum at protonmail.com. Just in case you want to get hold of me. Or if you have a guest. Later on, hopefully we'll have some... hopefully. We will have guests on. We'll talk about nonprofit organizations where you can go volunteer or be part of. We have a couple of them on lined up already. But if you want to reach out and email me, send an email to me there, and we can have them on. Mainly looking for social organizations that are looking for volunteers, have ways that their members get together. Pro-social capital. Pro-socializing. So, that's the idea. We'll get back into part six. This little segment called Lighting a Spark of Hidden Potential. Keep on listening. You better alternative, WRUV FM Burlington.
Lighting a spark. The expectations people hold of us often become self-fulfilling prophecies. When others believe in our potential, they give us a ladder. They elevate our aspirations and enable us to reach higher peaks. Dozens of experiments show that at work, when leaders hold high expectations, employees generally work harder, learn more, and perform better. In schools, when teachers set high expectations, students get smarter and earn higher grades, especially if they start out with disadvantages. Whereas high expectations offer support for us to climb, low expectations tend to hold us back. It feels like our boots are made of lead. It's called the Gollum effect. When others underestimate us, it limits our effort and growth. These kinds of self-fulfilling prophecies are particularly pronounced among stigmatized groups, who are frequently inundated by low expectations. But groundbreaking research by my colleague Samir Nurmohamed offers a twist. There are times when you can turn others' low expectations to your advantage. They don't have to strap you in place. You can grab onto them and pull yourself forward. In one experiment, Samir gave people a task where they had to click moving circles with their mouse. After they finished a practice round, an observer sent them a message. Some people were randomly assigned to receive high expectations.
You will blow others away in this task. I think you've got what it takes to beat all of them.
Others got low expectations.
Others will blow you away in this task. I don't think you've got what it takes to beat any of them.
The impact of these expectations depended on who was setting them. High expectations led to greater effort and performance, if they came from someone knowledgeable about the task. But if the observer lacked credibility, being uninformed about the task the effect reversed. People actually ended up trying harder and doing better when they were doubted rather than encouraged. When you're invested in a goal, being doubted by experts is a threat. They may be credible, but since they don't recognize your potential, they're not coaches who will help you improve. Their disbelief quickly becomes your insecurity. It shatters your confidence and stifles your growth. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But the research suggests that when they come from an uninformed audience, low expectations can become a self-negating prophecy. You're motivated to shatter their confidence that you won't succeed. Samir calls it the underdog effect. The underdog effect isn't limited to people with high self-confidence. Samir finds that low expectations from ignorant naysayers can be motivating regardless of whether you feel capable in the task. Being doubted by novices is a challenge. It fires you up. They're clueless, so you don't internalize their low expectations, but you don't ignore them either. You become driven to defy them. I'll show you. The doubts that threaten to crush your confidence can become crucibles that fortify it. You feel like an underdog who can beat the odds. Just ask Allison Levine. Carrying a torch. The desire to prove others wrong can light a spark of motivation. Turning the spark into a flame, though, often requires more. Ignorant naysayers may give us something to fight against, but a roaring fire comes from having something to fight for. It's easier to overcome obstacles when we're carrying a torch for people who matter to us. When others are counting on us, we find strength we didn't know we had. In one study, Marissa Shandell and I compared the performance of Olympic divers when they were competing individually versus in synchronized events with a partner. Divers were less likely to choke on the exact same difficult dives when they were doing it synchro rather than solo. You can see a similar pattern with kids in a version of the marshmallow test. In experiments in Germany and Kenya, kids had the chance to eat one cookie now or wait a few minutes to be rewarded with a second cookie. They delayed gratification longer when they knew caving in would also deprive another child of an extra cookie. Having a partner can prevent rumination about your own abilities. I can do this. And boost determination. I won't be the reason you fail. As Maya Angelou wrote, I do my best because I'm counting on you, counting on me. The Golden 13 found purpose in fighting for others and against low expectations. They faced far worse than typical naysayers. On multiple occasions, Navy leaders had to call out instructors for prejudice.
Many of them did not want any part of it,
lamented a white lieutenant, John Dill.
Petty officers had to be told that that attitude could not be displayed, that they must treat the men in the same fashion they would the whites.
Even then, multiple white instructors told them they would never make it. It was clear to the Golden 13 that their naysayers weren't qualified to judge them. Their lead instructor had only graduated from the Naval Academy 2 years earlier. He had less experience than many of them, and they felt he didn't know the first thing about their capabilities. They harnessed his doubts as motivational fuel. They decided to prove him wrong. Samuel Barnes pointed out,
there was hope by some that we would fail, so there'd be an excuse to just discontinue any ideas of commissioning black officers because they were just not competent, they were not intelligent enough. That gave us a greater determination to succeed. We'll say, we'll take advantage of this. We're going to do this because we're expected not to succeed.
To prove their naysayers wrong, they all had to make it. And they didn't want to let one another or their community down. We find our deepest reserves of resolve when an entire group is relying on us. My colleague Karen Knowlton has shown that when we feel a strong sense of belonging to a group, we feel our bootstraps are linked. We become driven to defy low expectations of our group in order to pull the entire group up. We don't just want to prove ourselves. We want to blaze a trail for others to follow. The Golden 13 knew they were representing something far bigger than themselves. George Cooper remarked,
we recognize that we worked hard and we failed. There were 160,000 men out there. We wouldn't have a shot at this for a hell of a long time. It was an awesome responsibility. We talked about it constantly.
They were pulling future generations up by their bootstraps. In the words of Jesse Arbour, "We learned to walk so that the ones behind us could run." They went far beyond breaking the color barrier for future Navy officers. The Golden 13 cleared many paths for their heirs to march on the way to achieving greater things. Dalton Baugh got a master's degree in engineering from MIT and became the Navy's first Black chief engineer. Dennis Nelson rose to lieutenant commander and ran a literacy program that educated thousands of sailors and enabled many to vote for the first time. Reginald Goodwin ran the Navy's selection office. Samuel Barnes earned his doctorate in educational administration and became the first Black officer of the NCAA. Still White served in the Illinois governor's cabinet and became a judge. He and George Cooper advocated for women's rights and gay rights in the Navy decades before doing so was common or accepted. It's more important to be good ancestors than dutiful descendants. Too many people spend their lives being custodians of the past instead of stewards of the future. We worry about making our parents proud when we should be focused on making our children proud. The responsibility of each generation is not to please our predecessors. It's to improve conditions for our successors. Not all about me. Prosocial skills are the glue that transforms groups into teams. Instead of operating as lone wolves, people become part of a cohesive pack. We normally think about cohesion in terms of interpersonal connection, but team building and bonding exercises are overrated. Yes, icebreakers and ropes courses can breed camaraderie, but meta-analyses suggest that they don't necessarily improve team performance. What really makes a difference is whether people recognize that they need one another to succeed on an important mission. That's what enables them to bond around a common identity and stick together to achieve their collective goals. This kind of cohesion is what the Golden 13 built to ace Navy officer training together. And it's what Richard Hackman eventually found was missing in too many intelligence units. In his research, most analysts were assigned to specific units, but that's all it really was, an assignment. They shared a boss and a water cooler, but not much else. They didn't spend enough time exchanging ideas, coaching one another, or learning together. When they sent reports to one another, it was mostly a formality. They were just checking a box. Putting people in a group doesn't automatically make them a team. Richard showed that the best groups of intelligence analysts gelled into real teams. They were evaluated on a collective outcome. They aligned around a common goal and carved out a unique role for each member. They knew their results depended on everyone's input, so they shared their knowledge and coached one another on a regular basis. That made it possible for them to become one big sponge. they were able to absorb, filter, and adapt to information as it emerged and evolved. Leaders play an important role in establishing cohesion. They have the authority to turn independent individuals into an interdependent team. But all too often, when it comes time to decide who takes the helm, we fail to consider the glue factor. When we select leaders, we don't usually pick the person with the strongest leadership skills. We frequently choose the person who talks the most. It's called the Babel effect. Research shows that groups promote the people who command the most airtime, regardless of their aptitude and expertise. We mistake confidence for competence, certainty for credibility, and quantity for quality. We get stuck following people who dominate the discussion instead of those who elevate it. It's not just the loudest voices who rise to lead even if they aren't qualified. The worst babblers are the ball hogs. In many cases, the people with the poorest pro-social skills and the biggest egos end up assuming the mantle at a great cost to teams and organizations. In a meta-analysis, highly narcissistic people were more likely to rise into leadership roles, but they were less effective in those roles. They made self-serving decisions and instilled a zero-sum view of success, provoking cutthroat behavior and undermining cohesion and collaboration. Sadly, the gravitation toward narcissistic leaders starts early. Psychologists find that narcissistic kids get more peer nominations as leaders and claim to be better leaders, even though they aren't. In 22 out of 23 Dutch primary and secondary school classrooms, the most leadership nominations went to the students most likely to agree with statements like, "Kids like me deserve something extra." When they grow up, those narcissists often wreak havoc on their teams. Collective intelligence is best served by a different kind of leader. The people to promote are the ones with the pro-social skills to put the mission above their ego and team cohesion above personal glory. They know that the goal isn't to be the smartest person in the room. It's to make the entire room smarter. Research demonstrates that when organizations have cultures that prize results above relationships, if they have a leader who puts people first, they actually achieve greater performance gains.
So I wanted to cut in a little bit, talk about that. So he's talking about organizations are not, they're trying to build a culture where like they're not putting people first, but the leader is the person that's putting the group first or the people in the group first. So it's kind of a counterintuitive thing, but I found that interesting. I just want to kind of highlight that little small snippet in what he was saying. So it's interesting. Organizations like, you're all working together while the leader's like, we're all part of the same team. So that kind of play between those two items. But let's let Adam Grant talk. So let's get right back to it.
When everyone is scrambling to make a rapid rescue, you want someone in charge who cares about everyone. Competence matters, but it isn't enough. Andre was certainly respected for his technical knowledge, but so were many other candidates. What set him apart was his reputation for pro-social skills. He was selected based on his ability to bring out the best in teams. An executive who recommended him observed,
"He has a lot of patience, an exceptional ability to listen and reach conclusions after listening to all sides."
We don't normally think of listening skills as vital to leadership. Around the world, great leaders are stereotyped as outgoing and assertive. In the United States, the vast majority of leaders and managers score above the midpoint on extroversion. The higher you look up the hierarchy, the more extroverts you find. Even in more traditionally introverted countries like China, extroverts are seen as the prototypical leaders. But one of my research projects examined whether extroverts are actually more effective leaders than introverts, and revealed a more nuanced picture of the ideal leadership style. What made for effective leadership depended on how proactive a team was. When teams were relatively reactive, waiting for direction from above, extroverts drove the best results. They asserted their visions and motivated teams to follow their lead.